Thanks, Anjani, for that mixed bag of an introduction. I don't recall the exact details of that. I do remember that, I think it was our time at the Maverick together, they referred to me as Rain Man. If so, you all look old enough to have seen the movie. It wasn't because of the physical resemblance with Dustin Hoffman, I'm pretty sure. Let me just set us up quickly. Can everyone hear? Is everyone happy? Dearly beloved, thank you so much for coming to our party. This is super exciting. So as Ranjani said, and as Lucanio said, I am a data nerd. I am the bruck compared to the rest of the thoroughbreds that we in discussion with, because I did a little bit of this and a little bit of that. My background is in economics and maths and stats and all that super sexy stuff. That is exciting. So, just to foreground what I'll be talking about before we have an interesting panel discussion is what we can do with the data science, what we have done, some of the more important trends, some of the broad backgrounds and the broad demographic trends that can help to set the scene and anchor whatever expectations we might have of what's going to happen. And we'll talk a little bit about the modeling process, how we model stuff, why we don't try and predict things too closely. I used to say I hate making predictions because I hate being wrong, and I still hold by that. But what we have done is we have put our heads on the block. There are a couple of predictions. There are a couple of scenarios. We're going to do the whole scenario planning futurist look at what might happen after the elections. But the thoroughbreds will discuss the implications. Because what I'll start out with is to talk about the limits of the data science, what we can do and what we can't do. Let me see if this thing works. That button. Okay. So what is data science? What is data science not? So if statistics and geography had a baby, maybe not the world's prettiest baby, that would be kind of what I do a lot of when it comes to elections and other things like basic education analysis. So it's a little bit of statistics, it's a little bit of geography, a little bit of maths. And now is probably not the time to go into confession mode, but you all look like nice people. The truth is I actually failed geography back in high school. I did. But I've made up for it because now the daily job is a lot about geography. Data science is science. Thank you. For the tautology, for it's not magic. What do we mean by that? That we use the scientific method. There are things that are tested, there are hypotheses that are floated, and then we revise the model after every election because, as the old saying goes, an economist is someone who will tell you tomorrow why what they forecast yesterday did not come true today. And I think what's very important to put forward as well and to demystify the process is it's not a silver bullet, it's not a magic bullet. It is part of the journalist toolkit. It's not something to replace traditional journalism. And what I'll show you in the next slide is how data science and data journalism can often be the starting point, but you still need the real journalists, the thoroughbreds, as I refer to them, very complimentary, in a very complimentary way, to chase the story, to confirm the suspicion or the hypothesis or to reject it. We can identify trends and themes. We're going to look at a few of those, as Ranjani has said. But when it comes to telling in-depth stories, you still need investigative journalism. You still need sources. You still need the human element, and you still need the contacts. And when it comes to the modeling process, we look at a probabilistic outcome. So the chances that this party will probably achieve a percentage within the range from A to B, not exactly a specific forecast of a specific outcome. When we look at our scenarios, we will look at what we're going to call, I'd say, the midpoints of the most probable outcomes. But don't come to me the day after the election and say, you said 57%, but it was 59, so you're 100% wrong. And anyway, the model and the forecast will probably change next week, and that's what makes it so exciting and hard to pin us down. Okay. Here's a map to illustrate what we talked about in the previous slide, is that the data science is a starting point, it's a jumping on point. Now what you're looking at here is a map of voter turnout for the previous election, for the national vote. general knowledge. This is supposed to be all interactive. I mean, not too many questions or comments. The, you know, questions that are more comments. Like, there are no stupid questions, just stupid people who disguise their comments as questions. Yeah. Sure, of course. It's a complimentary service. You've been so nice to come through so early on such a cold day. You'll be more than welcome. This, as I said, it's a map of voter turnout for the national vote. It's a little bit higher than the provincial vote. And does anyone remember, for no prizes whatsoever, but this is interactive, what the average voter turnout was for 2014? Almost right. It was about, if I'm not mistaken, 73%. But we'll confirm it in a slide or two. So what you're looking at roughly is the red parts of the map are turnouts above the average that was then. The cream color is roughly on average or a little bit below. And then the green and the darker green are turnouts that are very much under the average. Now looking at, can I actually... Oh, nice. So if you look at a specific ward, for example, that ward, there was a very high turnout. One ward in and of itself might not tell a story. It might just be that, as you know, on the day, the traffic was bad, so you couldn't go to your voting station and you went to the one next door. Probably more likely in an urban setting. But when you look at areas like this, where there's a whole area, many, many wards of dark green, or the province as a whole, and we'll look at provincial trends. Then you've got the jumping on point for a story. When you call the real journalists and you say, Ranjini, or for argument's sake, can we deploy someone on the ground to look at what's happening over here in Vulamehlo or Vuwani or what's going on? You know, is this a Vuwani story? The redemarcation of Vuwani only happened in the 2016 election, so already perhaps not. Is it a story maybe of migratory patterns, of a lot of people moving from Limpopo to Gauteng? Possibly. Is it a story of voter discontent and Limpopo voters not turning out? Possibly. And it feeds into historical trends that the ANC once won this province with around 80% of the vote in the early days, but their majority has been whittled down to the mid-60s. But it's fun, and it's pretty map, right? It's a pretty map. Incidentally, Ranjini, you're wrong. There was something exciting that happened in 2004 elections. It was the only time that the ANC actually won a two-thirds majority. I think.
No.
Am I wrong?
Just below. It's with the coalition that it was able to, with the minority front.
No, yes, it did.
All right, we'll confirm this later. There's a prize. There's a prize for anyone who can prove that Ranjini is wrong. All right. But again, and the data science is not a silver bullet. Here's the second part of the interactive game. What I've done is drawn a very suspect circle. You can see it's not a real circle. This is using very high-tech software like Microsoft Paint. Okay, so it's a little red line. A center of the circle whose origin is somewhere out there in the Atlantic Ocean. And what we've got is we've got the city of Cape Town Metro and a couple of other big municipalities inside the circle and the rest of the province outside the circle. Now, for absolutely no prizes, no money, no chocolate hamper or wine, what do you guys think is the ratio of the population of the Western Cape province inside the circle versus outside the circle? Anybody. You can only be wrong, or you can be wrong more than once. This is not true false, but 90% inside. 71. Okay. I probably have primed you by asking it in that way. But you guys are pretty close. It's about 81% of the population inside there. In fact, the city of Cape Town Metro by itself is about two-thirds of the population of the province. The province is about sitting at about 6.3 million, and there's about 4.2 million living in the city of Cape Town. So why did I show you the slide, apart from to demonstrate just how rubbish my freehand drawing skills are? Two things. One, the data science and the pretty software is no substitute for being able to brain properly, to think properly, to brain. Land is not people. These very big rural municipalities and wards, they look very impressive on the map. It's very exciting when the DA or the ANC wins a Northern Cape municipality from the other party, but it doesn't mean much in the bigger scheme of things. Okay. So the first thing is to understand what you're looking at. There is no substitute for experience and intelligence when interpreting it, and no amount of fancy software or pretty maps is going to make up for the lack of knowledge in the subject. What was my other point? Oh, yeah. Very poor drawing skills. What are some of our assumptions looking at past trends? There's a difference between national provincial elections and municipal elections. Our model leans more heavily on the national provincial elections. The results of those are more highly correlated with each other. 2016 was a wonderful time for opposition parties, particularly the DA, but the predictive power of 2016 is less important to us than 2014. And the by-elections themselves, which Ranjini alluded to, even less predictive power. And we'll talk about why. You might disagree, you'll still be wrong. I have been wrong before. I think it was a Thursday. The turnout, the two factors which are going to influence the outcome overall are the turnout of ANC voters and young voters, meaning very broadly 20 and 30-somethings. And I think what's important here is that a lot of people, political parties especially, try and tell the story from the end all the way back to the beginning and try and look at percentages of a total vote without taking into account that ANC voters have historically, and the ANC's share of the vote has been the numeraire, the determining factor, the starting point, the alpha, and sometimes the omega. The DA didn't, put it another way, the DA didn't win 2016 as much as the ANC lost it. And I think it's important to start, and this is how we start with the analysis, start from the point of the actual absolute number of votes. How many can each party be expected to get? What did they get before? Are they at their ceiling? What would happen if the propensity for ANC voters to turn out was to fall? How would that shrink the pie? And how would that subsequently affect all the other opposition parties' slices of the pie? Okay. As we know, low ANC turnout 2016 was devastating in Nelson Mandela Bay, in Gauteng metros, and there are over a third of the current registered voters are under the age of 35. Of course, that's exciting because everyone is wondering how many the EFF will capture. And from a modeling point of view, a low turnout is not just bad for the ANC in and of itself, it's also harder to model. The vote becomes more fractured, the smaller party shares, the ones below the big three, they become more prominent, and it's hard to tell a more accurate story. Okay. This ties into the map that we first showed of Limpopo. What I'm showing you here, don't concentrate, the numbers, they'll hurt your head. Oh no, they hurt my head. But what we're looking at here is the provincial vote over the last three elections, with the totals here at the bottom. Okay. I'm getting used to it. All right. Just under 16 million, just under 18 million, and then about 18.5 million over there. But what's interesting is those numbers in red, they represent a decrease from election to election. And what you can see quite clearly is that Limpopo has seen a decrease in turnout over the last two elections. Taken on aggregate, Eastern Cape has seen a decrease. Free State, more or less static, an increase of 9,000 over 10 years is nothing to write home about. And Northwest, huge decrease from 2004 to 2009, and then a slight increase there. By contrast, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape have seen an overall increase in the number of votes. So what's the take-home message? The take-home message here is that the larger the share of the total vote that each province manages to garner, the more MPs they send to the National Assembly through that provincial vote. And what we've seen, the trend over the last 10 years, is that Gauteng or Gauteng plus KwaZulu-Natal plus Western Cape are counting for a larger and larger share of those 200 of the 400 MP allocations. And that's important. So the battle for Gauteng is not just the battle for the money and what will happen to our schools and hospitals, but also an increasing share. I think getting on close to 50 out of 400 MP seats. Modeling election results, or how we, you know, terms and conditions apply, covering our bums. Deterministic versus probabilistic models. So when you see a poll from the Institute for Race Relations or from Afrobarometer, what's the other one that I keep forgetting? From Ipsos. Yes, been in the news a lot. You're looking at one very clear deterministic result. The ANC will get X percent, the DA will get Y percent, everyone else will get Z and A and B and C. And a lot is made of this. The IRR, the Institute for Race Relations, has been criticized. Ipsos has been criticized. But every event, whether it's a poll, whether it's an election or a by-election, is a one moment in time. People are complex. Ranjan is joking, but you know what she's getting at. A lot of us haven't decided who we're voting for. And who we decided who we vote for this week might change next week. If you took the pulse of the country 3 weeks ago when we were about 1.5 weeks into load shedding, outcomes would probably be a lot less favorable towards the ANC than they were if you polled people today. And if we enter load shedding in the 2 or 3 weeks heading up to elections, it may hurt the ANC a lot more than our model shows at the moment. So rather than try and say this is the absolute truth, the light and the way, we recognize people are complex, outcomes are random, there's a fair amount of uncertainty. We take the polls as a starting point. We take them as reference points. But we have to introduce some randomness into the model. And the model we use is called a Monte Carlo simulation. It's been used to model other elections. But its pedigree and its provenance are not used for silly, inconsequential things like elections, but for serious engineering and physical problems, how to model flows and air and liquids and all sorts of fancy things. And it's essentially like this. If I flipped a coin once, you know that the odds of getting ahead 50%, tails 50%. And you know, if you know a little bit about statistics, that if I flip two coins, the chance of getting two heads in a row falls from 50% to 25% and so on. But if you flip the coin 1,000 times, what are the possible outcomes? And they range all over the place. You might get 20 heads in a row. You might get 50 more tails than heads. And it's a completely random process. But it's possible to repeat this random process just using Excel or something. Oh, I've given away all the secrets. Please come back to the post-election analysis. I worry we've demystified this too much, Ranjini. Okay. So that's the process. Imagine you start with the assumption that an erstwhile ANC voter will stick with the party 70% of the time, will stay home 20% of the time, will change their vote to the EFF 9% of the time, and will vote for the DA 1% of the time. And you can replicate this process for a million such voters. And you can create all sorts of assumptions on the provincial level, on the party level, and so on and so forth. Replicate the process. And what the result is a number of different scenarios with different probabilities attached to all of them. So when we look at the outcomes of the model and the predictions and the scenarios, what we're looking at when we look at the house view is the most likely outcome. That outcome itself, that static look at the ANC will get X, the DA will get Y, might only occur 5% of the time. It might occur 7% of the time. The probability of a result very close to that result, a little bit higher or a little bit lower for all the parties, might occur another 5 or 10% of the time. So if you had to plot all these potential different outcomes, you'd get something that might resemble a distribution curve. And we are telling the story of the sweet spot. What is happening? What is most likely to happen? But it won't happen for definite. It might. Probably not. We don't know. No one knows. Okay. Here's some foregrounding. What we're looking at now is something called the theory of the three gates. I've been talking to IP lawyers. And it's basically a story of who gets to vote, how many people are going to get to vote. And I think it's a really good place to start. Of course I do. I've coined the phrase. And it goes like this. First gate, you have to be over 18 to vote. You can register at 16, but you have to be over 18. Second gate, you must be registered to vote. Third gate, you must show up on the day and vote. Sounds very simple. All right? But thinking about things this way and looking at potential voters as they move through or they are stopped at each of the gates and the numbers, the potential numbers that could move through each of the gates is a good place to start. And it gives a good idea. I'm hoping that this is going to be a good grounding for what we'll see in a month's time. Here is a snapshot of last election in 2014 compared to what's going to happen in a month's time. In 2014, I mean, how many people do we have in the country? And don't listen to those old Eskom ads which said, what was it, 47 million of us. They were already out of date when they'd hit the airwaves. But we were at somewhere between 50 and 57 million people. We were about 54, 55 million 5 years ago, and 34.5 million people over the age of 18. And of those, 25.4 million people were registered to vote when they closed the registration process. So about 74% of those 34.5 million people moved from the first gate through the second gate. And then on the day, just under 19 million people ended up voting. Oh yeah, there's that number. 73% of the people that were registered to vote ended up voting. That's what we'd colloquially refer to as the voter turnout rate. 54%, meaning 18.7 million people, is 54% of those people who could have voted. And that's good to remember. We always say, you know, it's not democratic. Only 3% of the people voted for Trump and 2.8% of the people voted for Hillary and the Electoral College. It's so rubbish. But it's good to have a grounding. It's good to know what we're looking at. Here's something which is potentially another trendsetter for 2019, but not in a good way. We might actually end up with fewer people voting in a month's time than we did 5 years ago. What do we got now? 37.8 million people are over the age of 18. 26.8 million of those are registered to vote. Now, I already see the drop-off from the first to the second grade. Here, there's 3.3 million more people who could vote, who are over the age of 18 compared to 5 years ago. But we only have 1.4 million people more that are registered to vote than were 5 years ago. There's a couple of reasons for this. We've only had one registration weekend. The IEC has had its hands full because it's had a constitutional court ruling that said it has to provide addresses for registered voters that are as complete as possible. And it's spent a lot of resources and a lot of time complying with the Concord. And it's done a fantastic job. But it has meant that it hasn't been able to pursue its primary mandate or the work that it wants to prioritize, which is registering people. Okay. Doing the maths, if turnout falls to just 70%, which is entirely possible given voter apathy, disillusionment, the 9 wasted years, the failed New Dawn, Bosasa, Zondo Commission, the lights being out, Zilla defending colonialism,
Gangster state.
If turnout falls to just under 70%, we won't get more than the 18.7 million people that voted that were there 5 years ago. Another, yes, sir. That's a very good question. Let me just check. Oh, I am connected. Let's talk about these trends quickly. Let me put them up, but let's talk about them as well. Just putting those up there to look at. So what we've seen, and this is a good question because it refers back. Let me just put on my nerd disguise quickly.
How did the screen die?
I don't know. That's what I was worried about, that there was power issues.
Don't you need to touch the screen? Maybe it's going to sleep
back. Okay. Can everyone still see the screen? I know it's dark and considerable. Okay. We'll see. We'll play it by ear. I'll make up some slides. So here are the facts. Let's start from the first grade and work the way through. We have a population age distribution which is somewhere between a developing and a developed country. We've broken the back of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Our death rates have fallen. Our birth rates have fallen. But if we look at the over 18s, the largest age cohort is the 20-somethings. We're still relatively young. The median age of a South African is around 26, 27, 28. So there are more 20-somethings than 30-somethings. There are more 30-somethings than 40-somethings. When it comes to passing through the second gate, the registration, the percentage of people in each age cohort that are registered to vote goes up as the age cohorts get older. Only about 10% of 18 and 19-year-olds are registered to vote. about half of all 20-somethings are registered to vote. But from 30-somethings onwards, those numbers rise to rates of about 80 and then eventually 90%. And I mean, the reason is quite simple. This is an old joke. It's not funny. It goes something along the lines of, the oldest man in the world has died again. Why does this keep happening? So the point is, oh no, it's not that funny. A lot of nervous laughter on, what's he going to say next? Once you register to vote, you're on the voter's roll until you die. And Ranjini and I said, even after you die, sometimes you're not removed from the voter's roll because the registered voter rate of over 80-year-olds is 112%. There are more registered voters over the age of 80 than there are according to the census. Okay, we're not headed towards Zimbabwe territory, I promise. To put it in context, we've got about 30 or 40,000 over 80-year-olds that are registered in excess of the numbers that there should be in the census. And it probably just means that the Home Affairs is a bit slower than the IEC and hasn't removed dead voters from the voters' roll. But if all the over 80-year-olds vote for Cloudy or someone like that, you'll know that there's been voter fraud. It's highly unlikely. So, that's the second gate. The third gate is who turns up to vote on the day. We don't have exit polls. We do have some data from the IEC. And in 2014, the age group that had the highest propensity to vote, having been registered, so saying, of those that moved through the second gate, what percentage then moved through the third gate? It was the 50 and 60-year-olds. So there's a weaker trend again, similar to those that passed through the second gate, that says the older you are, the more likely you are to vote on the day. But it drops off after the age of 60. It might be transportation issues. It might be personal issues of older voters not getting to the voting station. It might be a whole bunch of ghost voters. Does that long-winded reply answer your question? No. Sorry, please ask it again, maybe with smaller words.
So what I'm interested in is registration rate has dropped.
Yes.
Okay. The second gate. Yes. From 74 to 71.
Yes.
Is there historical evidence based on 6-5 data points, whatever it is, that suggests that the third gate rate will drop as well? 73 will drop to, say, 70.
Good question. Okay, got it. Short answer. Not strong evidence one way or the other. There's a couple of reasons why people might fail to move from one gate through to the other. Here, I think the strongest evidence for this time around is that the IEC just had its hands full and wasn't able to have a second voter registration weekend. In fact, if you look at by-elections since 2016, the registered number of voters in each ward is lower than it was in the general elections, as the IEC has probably had to remove people from its voters' roll or couldn't verify certain details, not to the threshold required by the Constitutional Court. So there's that, and that's a new development. It's not clear we'll pan out. Quickly going through some of the stuff we talked about. The 20-something age cohort is the largest through the first gate, but older people, and this is a global trend, older voters, older registered voters are more likely to vote on the day. Here's what's interesting. Women are better voters than men. About 52% of us are women, and this is an average. What I mean is, out of every 100 of us, 52 will be women. Not that we all don't, I'm not saying we don't all have a feminine side to us. You know what I'm saying? Okay. 52% of the population is women. 55% of the registered voter population is women. 57% of the people that end up voting, this is mainly looking at 2014 and 2009, are women. So almost 6 out of 10 voters are women. And yet the only thing I've seen is one article by President Ramaphosa in the Daily Maverick saying the new dawn will be built by women. Which is good messaging. It's not a lot. It's one article. And it's not, I don't know, I find it, what do you think, as a woman? Okay, thanks. And we talked about that.
Sorry, Paul.
Yes.
Just about keep interrupting. Women have different voting patterns than men.
We don't, here's the thing. Unfortunately, we're lacking that info. We don't have exit polls. And what the exit polls that the IEC has run have been more about voter perceptions and satisfaction with the voting process and the registration process, which is more to help the IEC do its job better in the future. But exit polling is illegal. You're not allowed to ask people. There are issues. People tend to lie and say they voted for the winning party, and that's a global thing because People are liars everywhere. But we don't know. Beyond the split by age cohorts, we don't really know who's more likely or less likely to vote. We know broadly, yes, women are more likely to vote than men. Older voters more likely to vote than younger voters, but not who these people are voting for. We could look very broadly. What we do is we overlay census data on the ward level with voting turnouts, and certain things pop up. If there's time, we'll talk about that in a bit. But on a very broad level, men versus women, we don't know. Okay. Some of you have kids. Some of you were kids once. This looks like those great little mosaic sticker books. Do you remember those? But it's actually my representation of the 2014 Parliament. So what you have here is 10 by 40 grid. There's 400 parliamentarians. We put the DA and its putative coalition allies on the left. ANC this way. So when I was looking with Ranjini and I hadn't tilted the screen, she's like, there's no difference. And it's tough. But, I mean, this is green and that's blue. Is everyone? Because I was like, otherwise this whole slide is going to fall flat. They're not arranged. They're not aligned in terms of stronger coalition preferences versus weaker. They're just arranged after the ANC and the DA in terms of who had more seats in the National Assembly. So after the DA, the party most likely to vote with the DA is the IFP, and they had 10 seats and so on. And we've put the EFF in the middle. So the point of this is, you know, there are some people who are nervous. What does a two-thirds majority mean? And expropriation without compensation. And Julius will become deputy president. All these things. So what I wanted to show here, and this is not to allay your fears, I'm really sorry, is that the EFF has historically, 2014, been a necessary and sufficient condition for a two-thirds majority. What would a simple majority look like? I've drawn the line there. So 200 plus 1, 201 out of 400, what would a two-thirds majority look like? 267 seats out of 400, assuming everyone shows up to vote, which never happens because they're parliamentarians. But you see here that even with all of the other coalition partners, the ANC still needed the help of the EFF to get over the two-thirds line. And if we draw it a different way, if we push the EFF all the way to the left, and we only look at the EFF as a coalition partner, you see that the ANC can get to the two-thirds majority just with the EFF. They can't do it without the EFF, and they can do it just with the EFF. That's historically. And what's interesting when we look at scenario planning and forecasts for the upcoming elections is that under most scenarios and most modeling, the ANC plus EFF is always two-thirds. Not every case. That's something to keep in mind. As I said, this is not a safe space. Three outcomes, three scenarios. Here's the fun part. You want to know what's going to happen. So this is what will definitely probably maybe happen. There's a good chance. It might not. Here's the House view. Scenario one, ANC loses 4% of the vote. And again, as the model stands at the moment, we're looking at a distribution of the ANC most likely getting in the mid-50s. So this 57 is probably as likely as the ANC getting 59 or falling to 55. But it gives you an idea. It's still a solid hold nationally. It's not a two-thirds. Ranjini will have words later. 2004, I'm pretty sure this gentleman agrees with me. So that's the first scenario, the House view. The ANC loses about 4 or 5 percentage points, or a little more, a little less, compared to last time. The DA more or less holds steady. The EFF does very well. The IFP recovers a teeny bit, and the others share the difference. In most scenarios, the EFF is the biggest winner, and that I think we'll stand by, we'll say, in terms of absolute votes, in terms of percentage point increases, the EFF is the party most likely to win in these elections. Scenario 2 and Old Dawn, and I'll just want to point out scenarios 2 and 3 are both highly unlikely. They represent pretty much the edge points of what the model would turn out, you know, with a chance of 1% maybe. Of course, if the ANC does get 68 or 69, I was never here. All right. In a highly improbable alternate universe, which will happen maybe one out of every 200 or 300 times. The ANC gets 67%. The DA drops to 18. The EFF does slightly better, and the smaller parties, including the IFP, hold steady. And this would take the ANC all the way to its second two-thirds majority. And then again, scenario three, a new game. The ANC falls below 50% nationally. The DA and the EFF both make very big gains. This is the only scenario, as I said, where the ANC plus EFF is less than that two-thirds. And the smaller parties do better proportionately because they are sharing pieces of a smaller pie. Now, we will talk to the real journalists in a little bit about the implications of this. It's relatively easy, looking at census data, demographic data, to predict what might happen in terms of numbers. It is much harder, if not impossible, although they can probably give it a good shot, to predict what will happen afterwards. Not only did very few of us, me included, predict in 2016 that the ANC would lose Nelson Mandela Bay and Joburg and Tshwane, but no one could have predicted the shenanigans and all the other fun and games that would have happened with the shifting sands of the coalition. I think in retrospect, we can probably predict that, he's not in the audience, is he? That Gayton and the Patriotic Alliance will be happy to swap sides depending on who's offering them a better position. But beyond that, not much. You know, no one would have predicted that we would see more minority governments. They just, the theory behind it was that these are inherently unstable and it's more likely that there'll be coalitions. Good question. In general, the turnout we're looking at is falling. We're looking at a turnout of, where last time was 73%. We're looking at a turnout closer to the high 60s, 67, 68 for that first scenario. But for the second scenario, a much higher turnout, so probably in north of 70%. And in the third scenario, a much lower turnout, a turnout that would be even closer to 60%, which we don't think is going to happen. I'm going to move along quickly, but I think we'll talk about this more in the panel, to say that there's a conventional wisdom that there's a sweet spot for the ANC. There's a sweet spot for Ramaphosa and for a reform agenda, that if the ANC gets a certain amount, the party will not get enough that it can just be complacent and say, well, we can do to the electorate what we want, but it will not get enough that the Ramaphosa and his faction can feel safe. Not my ideas. I mean, this is now the popular wisdom, but I'm sure we'll discuss it more. Okay, I'm going to move on very quickly. I know we're running out of time. I've told all the terrible jokes I can. Couple more predictions on the provincial level. Gauteng is very close to call. Don't ask me. I will not be here. But there's we roughly flip a coin to see if the ANC gets above 50% or not. That's not the same as saying that the party will lose control of the province. The party is still in the driver's seat when it comes to forming a coalition. And again, when it comes to political power, we are eventually going to be looking at seats in the provincial legislature and not votes. So maybe the ANC will end up needing one or two seats in coalition. Maybe it'll go to the EFF, maybe the DA, maybe the Freedom Front Plus. The DA should hold on to the Western Cape. The DA's own polls give Patricia de Lille's party not much more than 3%. Under most scenarios, the party shouldn't get more than 5. The DA did only retain the province with, I think, a high 50s, 57 or 58 last time. So its majority could be whittled away. And the ANC should hold on to all the other party provinces, despite what the DA say about the Northern Cape. Similar map, we don't have time, but if there was a map like the one I showed you in the Western Cape, that little sliver, that Francis Bart district municipality with Kimberley and the provincial seat of power and those very densely populated, relatively densely populated areas on the border of Northwest is half of the province. So you can look at the vast, you know, rolling scrublands and the sheep and the large square kilometer array telescope, but that's not where the power lies. And there's a good chance the ANC losing some power in KwaZulu-Natal. The 2014 results in KwaZulu-Natal actually masked the losses in the other provinces. I don't think that will happen this time. Last slide. One or two more scenarios from left field and beyond. DA loses the Western Cape. Could happen. Low turnout of ANC voters, tired of Zilla's tweets, the attack on the lack of spatial transformation, Phyllis Joel's school in Sepoy and Philippi, Aquifer in Philippi, all these things, the Lille's party could pick up votes, unlikely to happen. ANC loses the Northern Cape, we've spoken about that. under a scenario of low ANC turnout and significant growth in the opposition vote, highly unlikely. Those areas where the people live in the Northern Cape and where most of the votes come from is also, again, the seat of the provincial power. There's a lot of government jobs there. There's relatively strong support for the ANC. ANC loses the Northwest. I find the Northwest a very interesting province. I don't think that the ANC will lose, but there are parties, not just the EFF, parties like the Forum for Service Delivery that have grown over the by-elections. This is a contested area. This is an area where the EFF actually has constituency-based seats. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm sure you all have a lot to think about from this presentation. My problem with it, though, is that I saw all this being done in the U.S. before the 2016 presidential elections, as well as a lot of polling and a lot of exit polling, and they still got it wrong. What we're trying to do is offer some insight as to what can happen, but not what will happen. And the thing is that, I think it's difficult to plot voting trends. I think you asked, for example, about women voters, how they've changed. And that's the kind of data that we don't have in the country, is terms of how voting perception has moved in different groups of people. But to take the discussion forward, I'm now going to call upon a group of my colleagues at TESO Blackstar. So first of all is Genevieve Quintal, was the political editor of Business Day. Sikonati Manchancha was the deputy editor of the Financial Mail. And Kanita Hunter was a political journalist at the Sunday Times. So please welcome them. Let me pull this so I can see you. Okay, so just to start off, Paul, from what we've seen in your presentation, a lot of this depends on voter turnout, right? And what we need to know is, so from what you're saying, a higher turnout favors the ANC.
Correct.
But a higher turnout in opposition strongholds favors the opposition.
That's also correct. Okay. So let's maybe look at 2016 as an illustrative example. It's not the same kind of election, but it does illustrate a couple of things quite nicely. How what counts in our voting system, which is a proportional representation based system. So like we said, there were 60 wards in Nelson Mandela Bay, and the ANC won 35 of them. That's a majority. But it still ended up losing the metro and getting far less than the DA. The DA, I think, got 57%, the ANC, 57 seats out of 120. The ANC only got 50 seats out of 120. And that was because the areas where the DA did well, they did very well. There was turnout of 70 or 80% in the DA-led wards. The DA captured 80, 90% of the wards where it had strongholds. The ANC won its wards with 50, 60, 70% at best. So that was low ANC turnout, that was high DA turnout. The ANC historically, just by the numbers, has got far more voters than the DA does. The DA pushed hard. It actually won more votes in an absolute number in 2016 than it did in 2014. And it pushed hard. I know it seems tough now with all the robocalls and, this is Musi Maimane wanting to have an intimate 3-minute discussion with you over voicemail. But it started in 2016. If you look more at Gauteng, if you look at traditional strongholds, Soweto, Mamelodi, places like that, the DA didn't grow its vote that much. The DA, in absolute numbers, might have won 300, 400, 500 more votes per ward. But ANC support fell by 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 votes.
Okay, so the ANC turnout is the variable. What you're saying is the DA is fairly standard, but the DA is the variable.
The ANC is a variable just because the ANC has 11, 12 million, 50 million? How many millions more votes? Three times the number of votes. So A couple of points. The DA in the last election probably reached the limit of its base. It has to grow into traditional black African areas if it wants to increase its share of the vote. The ANC and the EFF are not doing much to attract opposition votes.
Okay.
The DA has locked up most of the minority votes, but it is the traditional ANC voter, largely black African voters, their turnout, staying at home, switching parties, is going to have the biggest effect.
Okay. So, Sikonathi, a lot of what we're talking about here seems to depend on whether people turn out or not. And what all of us do as part of our daily lives is monitor political patterns, political events, political developments, and how they impact on the country, on our lives. Do you think that everything that happened in the past few years is likely to make people more willing to want to vote, angrier so that they vote deliberately, or vote because they think it's the right thing to do, or vote against something?
What has happened over the last, give it the Jacob Zuma years, has actually made people stay away, because in South Africa, particularly the black people who were victims of apartheid and the older ones, rather than vote for anybody else and against the ANC, they'd stay at home. The past 9 years, they've done exactly that. Jacob Zuma was really successful in propping up the opposition by keeping people at home. Yes, he appealed to a certain kind of people. Now he's gone. Cyril Ramaphosa holds no charm whatsoever. He's just a dry old man who's looking for votes. But on the other hand, you've got Musi Maimane, who really sounds preachy but very hollow. There's no content in him. You can already feel there's someone behind him, like holding him by the scruff, like, talk, and he does exactly that. So I don't see the real person that does have appeal to a certain kind of people is Julius Malema. He just tells them what they want to hear. So he is most likely to get his supporters out. Ramaphosa will do a better job than Zuma, but he will certainly not pull the ANC out, because even in his in the last 12 months, 15 months, he hasn't done much, at least for the people on the ground, to see that things have really changed. What they do see is that there certainly is less new allegations of corruption than there were a year ago.
Okay, Kanisa, you've been tracking the president on the election trail. So you've seen his reception in communities. I don't know whether you share the view that he's a scruffy old man and not doing much. What's been your impression on the election trail? Do you think that Cyril Factor has the ability to pull more people to the voting booth?
I mean, if you have to look at superficial things like charm and popularity, there's some sort of difference between, you know, if you compare two presidents, right? But I do think that this election is fascinating for me because of the type of content that people, ordinary people, are kind of engaging on. And there's some sort of level. And last week we had a discussion about the, you know, I'm just using this as an example, you know, the hand of food parcels in electioneering. And you see that that's not a factor in a lot of communities. Like, I've been all over the country, you know, especially on the Ramaphosa campaign trail. And you realize that there's almost like an intelligence that has been developed with the voter, where they are not, them tolerating BS is a little less than it was in previous elections. And I see that...
It's BS bullshit.
Yes. FYI. But you know, it's quite fascinating. And what I found really fascinating is, for example, having the president go to Katlehong, for example, and engaging people, and, you know, a lady's complaining about the state of her home. And when the president wants to make that, you know, that tempting empty promise of, no, we're going to build houses, and, you know, the lady's looking at him and saying, but where are you going to get money for that? You know, that kind of engagement. So I really, really find I find a difference on the receiving end of voters and people in different areas, where it's not unheard of for a community in a rural area to listen to the president and applaud the president when he's talking about an investment summit, but don't care when he's talking about the successes of no free, no fee schools and that kind of thing. So I think there's also that kind of challenge when it comes to political parties. And I think also the opposition is facing that somewhat, where there's a little bit more scrutiny, which I suppose it's a good thing and a bad thing in some elements. I mean, I don't know whether this is, can be empirically backed up. But I do think that there is this kind of interrogation, and this has forced political parties and political politicians outside of their comfort zones. And where you see this, another level of how the engagement happens compared to what we've seen in the past, where we say we're taking it for granted that this entire area of Katlehong is going to be ANC strongholds. And so that was an important thing that I've seen so far in the elections. The other thing that I've seen is the ANC has realized that the theatrics around elections is not going to win them votes. And I think they realized it from the Zuma years of the big parties, the big events, the big showing of things. Because, and I suspect that this is the EFF had put a stumbling block in their way in that regard, where now people actually have to work for their votes. And I think that the party, they may or may not doing it properly, but they've definitely realized that that arrogance that they've shown, I think 2016 was the humbling year of saying that arrogance of, we're all going to vote, we're the party of Mandela, you guys are going to vote for us. I think that has changed a little bit to the point where, we need to actually, do something more. I think it's obviously too late in terms of an ordinary voter who has no water, that kind of thing. But I do think that that change in the approach to electioneering may shift things a little than what was in the past.
Okay. So, Jen, you were the other day at President Ramaphosa's interaction with, what did he call it? White counterparts or something bizarre. Yes. This election, his personality and his entry into the game is defining a lot of the conversation around this election. The ANC is pushing him hard. As the top of their ticket. And the opposition, well, the DA at least, is trying to use him as an attack point or to separate him from the ANC, but also to pinpoint that he was actually part of the nine wasted years or part of the nine wasted years. How much of a factor is he, do you think, in terms of people's perception of these elections, whether they want to vote or not vote? And can you really are people able to separate him from the ANC?
I don't think you can separate him from the ANC, and I think it's easy to forget that he was sitting there for the last 5 years, and I think even sometimes us as the media give him a free pass on that. I think he has a lot to answer for on that. Look, they tell us, and if we look at what came out of the state capture inquiry, that the former president Jacob Zuma basically would override decisions and go against what the majority said. But I still think, could he have been more outspoken at that time? Could he have been?
But do you think people are asking that question enough, or is there this faith in the Ramaphosa presidency that he can change South Africa for the better?
I don't think people are asking that enough. I do think there's hope, and I think because, like we say, we've had the nine wasted years, people are looking for hope. We are looking for a better future, for things to change, and people are grasping onto that. He can't do it alone. And I think that's what people are forgetting. He's got quite a fractured party behind him. He can't make decisions. I know, and I've spoken to a few people, like he needs to be more decisive. He's now the president. He can say, no, we're not going to do that. But it doesn't work that way. So in the end, how much is he actually going to be able to do as an individual with the party he has behind him? With Ace Magashule sitting at Natuli House, what is he actually going to be able to do? I'm not sure yet if we give him a bigger majority or if he gets a bigger majority in the elections, if he's going to have a bigger mandate and have more power to make certain decisions, or whether he's still going to be held back by what's happening in the party. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay. So, Siganati, you've been dealing a lot with the Eskom crisis, and it is, I think, a defining crisis of this era. It speaks to the story of state capture and the damage to institutions. It talks to how precarious our future is, because there's so much that depends on the availability of electricity. So the economy, investment, delivery, everything depends on the lights to stay on. This issue of load shedding in the past few weeks, and the announcement by Minister Gordon that if it happens now, it will be stage one. How much do you think all of these issues around Eskom, the electricity crisis, have impact on the public psyche?
Anjini, that's a very simple yet very complicated question. The biggest majority of people in this country have had load shedding forever. Mm-hmm. My home on the Wild Coast, in the Transkei, only got connected to the grid on the 9th of August, 2018.
That's my birthday.
2018?
Yes, last year. Now, you can't tell me about load shedding. If I'm there. If I've had electricity all my life in Sandton, then load shedding is a very big matter. And by the way, the past 2 weeks that you guys were subjected to load shedding here, I was in the Eastern Cape, there was absolutely no load shedding. And that's where the majority of votes come from for the African National Congress. It's lost Gauteng, it's lost the big cities, but it's got the rural areas. Where there are no jobs, people receive the payment, social grants and old pension. That's the biggest income earner. So with those people, load shedding does not matter. They don't have jobs anyway. They've been retrenched from the mines starting early 90s, coming back home. So for the majority of people in this country, those who are in the outside of the main economic centers, load shedding is not a factor. Mm. For the urban population, it definitely is a factor. Mm. Except nobody is exploiting it.
But isn't the DA exploiting it?
No, it's not. They are going half-hearted. You go for the kill. If I was Musi Maimane or the DA, I would put a big picture of Atul Gupta on the highway and said, proudly brought to you by the ANC. The next billboard, Brian Molefe, a huge picture, proudly brought to you by the ANC. A darkened Eskom, broken bulbs, proudly brought to you by the ANC. Make sure the people who will be voting in those centers affected by load shedding every day do not forget it. Mm. They are not doing it. You go to the scene of the crime to drive the message home. The other big failure that people are not talking about, the ANC is marching against itself in Alexandra daily. Who has been in charge, who is in charge of their township. Mm. The leaders of those so-called protest marches, the so-called leaders there are actually ward councillors of the ANC who have been in power for the past 25 years. Mm. So it's not 9 wasted years, it's 25 wasted years. Nobody is exploiting that in the opposition. Mm. That's just one big municipal failure in the heart of Sandton. Go to a major town like Mthatha in the Eastern Cape. Pick any street. You need actually a grader to shovel the rubbish. Mm. Because municipality has completely broken down. Mm. Who is in charge? So Is load shedding a big factor? Yes, it is for industry. It is for urban people. For the real voters of the ANC, it is not. Because for the first time, they've had electricity. And then David Mabuza can stand up in parliament and say, this is a sign of growing economy. He is right. looked at it that one way. He is absolutely correct. But nobody is exploiting the load shedding thing. It should be a major issue. It's not.
So, Paul, you've been plotting.
I've been plotting.
You've been plotting the shifts and changes in terms of national provincial elections, municipal elections, as well as by-elections. Yes. Do all these factors, all these issues that we've been dealing with politically, you know, and all the major crises in Kandla, state capture, Eskom, blah, blah, Bosasa, does it impact physically in terms of how people vote and shifts in voting patterns?
Ranjini, it's not always easy to see the trend. It's not always easy to see a strong trend. I'll give you an example. In the aftermath of Marikana, about 2 or 3 weeks later, there was another round of by-elections. It might have been a month or two later. And there were a couple of wards in Rustenburg, ANC wards, which the party retained. Sure, with a reduced majority, but nothing out of the ordinary compared to other wards that the ANC had defended in that round of by-elections. Okay, it wasn't in the heart of the problem. It was a couple of wards to the east, but it was in the same municipality. And you might have assumed conventional wisdom, pollsters and analysts, that there'd be a direct effect. What we can look at is these longer-term, broader trends. We won't talk the challenges with analyzing by-elections now. They'll take a bit of time maybe later. But there's a couple of guesses and there's a couple of assumptions you can make about voter behavior. But as we've said before, without exit polls and things like that, it can be difficult. We can talk about phenomena like partisanship and negative partisanship. Partisanship would be if I look at the Institute for Race Relations polls and you look and you kind of look at their different turnout scenarios and you see that the EFF vote is pretty consistent, you can say it's a reasonable assumption to say of the three major parties, the EFF support is probably the most partisan and the most loyal. It's off a lower base. It's not like, you know, they're probably very partisan and loyal ANC supporters, and those are part of the party's base. But on the margins, the ANC is more likely to lose votes. There's things like negative partisanship. So I'll give you an example. It's when I walk past two synagogues on Saturday morning to pray at that one, I'm like, wherever I go, I'm definitely not going there. So that was supposed to get bigger laughs. Anyway. Obviously, I think you have to be Jewish to understand. Thank you, one man. But the idea is that it's the flip side of the coin. Just as you know, I will always vote for this party. I will never vote for another party. I would rather stay home on the day than not vote for the ANC. The voters will go, I will vote for anyone but the ANC. There might have been voters in the past that voted for a smaller opposition party and say, I will vote for the DA just because it's a strategic vote and it will limit the power of the ANC. So all of these assumptions about voter behavior, some of it is supported, some of it can be teased out from the numbers, and some of it you put into the model and you say within certain reasonable parameters. We know, looking at 2016 and even at by-elections, that the EFF has grown in traditional ANC areas. Mm. That if the ANC is going to lose votes to another party, it is highly likely it will be to the EFF. Mm. If we look at City of Cape Town, even those wards that the ANC won in Khayelitsha, it won, its majority went from 80% down to 65% because the EFF picked up 10-15%. Mm. So those are the things we know. We've got some assumptions on different groups of voters and what they might or might not do, that this is their first most popular, second most, third most likely choice.
So Jen Sigonati says nothing much has happened in the past year. So if you look at from 2016 and the amount of discontent there was people like Nomvula Mokonyane who said, we don't need your dirty votes then. And Jesse Duarte said, Nkandla doesn't matter. But a lot has happened since then. But So Sikonathi says there isn't much difference, but we've been going through these commissions. We've had the whole SARS process and the cleanup of SARS. You've had all these revelations at the state capture inquiry. You had the appointment of a national director of public prosecutions. Do you think that gives sufficient hope to people who say, let's kind of javelin forward, that yes, there's this entire mess now, there's the ANC factional battles, but with all these things that have been put in place, that it's still worth voting ANC because all these things are put in place and things will start to happen, even though we haven't had prosecutions?
I think the sentiment changes. I don't think it's so definite that, okay, we've got a new SARS commissioner, we've got a new NDPP, and it's all good and well that we've got, and it is good strides. It was necessary. There's still the cleanup behind those people, because obviously those institutions, although we have a new SARS commissioner, we know that within SARS there are still issues, there are still people there, Alliance and Moyani, same with the NDPP. We still need to find out if the Mokgoro inquiry is going to find that Jiba is not fit to hold office. So we make good gains, and then I think people are hopeful, and then we have we go to State Capture Commission, and these allegations come out, and there's allegations about ANC senior leaders. Then we had the whole list process, mm-hmm. and you find those ANC leaders on the list, and people then are thinking, but what about the cleanup? We've heard all these allegations. We've heard the ANC talk about, I think it went back to as far as 2012, that if you're facing allegations, that maybe for the good of the party you should step aside, but this isn't happening. So if those people are still going to go to parliament, I think, like I said, we make gains and then we seem to take a step back. And mm-hmm. So I don't think voters or people are that set yet. And maybe I'm wrong that this is definitely, yes, this is great, we're going to, because it seems to change every few weeks. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can say for definite that there's a lot more hope, but I don't think we can say for definite that, okay, yes, things are moving forward. Let's vote ANC and carry on moving forward with that.
I think you are right, because I think that we have seen that. So, for example, when Shamila Butoi was appointed, I think there was a period of that we were all on a high, that this is a credible person, things can start to happen. But then, you know, as time passes, as she's trying to stabilize the NPA, we didn't count on that. We just thought people are going to be marched to court and, you know, we'll stay on that high. And I think that's where the plunge comes.
And there's very interesting little things in between that, because with the NDPP, and I think I've seen some stories, and Shamila Butoi said President Cyril Ramaphosa has also said it, let's wait for the findings of the Zondo Commission and then we can work on prosecution. So you think, well, we're supposed to have this special directorate who's supposed to be looking into these allegations now, but if we keep hearing let's wait for the end of the Zondo Commission, we're going to wait another year. I think they said they want to be finished by March next year completely. It could be extended again. So you're telling us actually in this next year everyone's still innocent until proven guilty, and we must all just hold our hands up and just wait.
Yeah.
And can we wait another year? Or do people want to wait another year to see action being taken?
Kanita, you've been reporting on the issues around the NPA.
Yeah.
And this is, I think it's a major factor in terms of ensuring accountability for what has happened over the past few years and removing this kind of impunity that exists in the nation. But it is a slow drag, right? Yeah. So things are starting to happen. So there are things happening in the NPA now. But it's not good. There isn't going to be kind of instant gratification from this, right?
Absolutely. And I think that the biggest failure of the narrative around this election is the underestimation of the rot that actually happened and the dysfunction that set in and the dismantling of institutions of state more than the criminal justice system, where you're literally having a political system that's hanging on ropes because the state has been weakened. Yeah. And I think this is more precarious than a situation where you had a dodgy man in office. Here you have a state that's basically crumbling or has crumbled, and I think that's the biggest issue, and it manifests itself in the NPA, where you see you know, these just inaction, and you know, there's almost this kind of frustration. Last weekend, this past Sunday, we reported on this new crack team that she's, and I had a discussion with someone at the NPA, and I said to them, you know, give us anything, you know, can you just, has there been any movement? And they said, no, wait. And I said, this is more about me trying to find a story. It's more about people that are so frustrated at where, you know, this common line that Ramaphosa throws around everywhere, where he says, "Watch the space." Mm. And you know, people are saying, you know, we've been watching, you know, and I think that for me, the you know, Sekunati is talking about the you know, there hasn't been enough exploitation of what the situation really is, but I do think that. Any voter has to go into that voting booth realizing that the state of dysfunction is the state is at a state of dysfunction, and the politics is almost a sideshow from what really is at play here. Mm. But the one question that I wanted to actually pose to Paul Ranjini is: we have 48 political parties just on the general. Why, given your predictions of how things are and the why do people still believe it's such a lucrative thing to start political parties? And this ultra democracy, is it assisting democracy or is it hampering it? That's something I'm just, because literally the ballot is going to be unprecedented, 48 on just on the general ballot.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I wish you hadn't asked. No, I'm kidding. But a quick drive-by. We got a proportional representation system. And unlike similar countries, Scandinavian countries, Italy, maybe Israel, there's no threshold for the vote you get. The Israelis are going to vote. And if a party, it's like you must be this high to go on this ride. If a party polls less than, I think, 3.25%, whatever they get doesn't count. It'll get redistributed to bigger parties. We don't have such a threshold. You got the PAC that won one seat last time, I think, with about a fifth of a percent of the vote. Okay, and it makes it exciting. And one thing we didn't touch on is, you know, are we consolidating or are we fracturing the vote? And it can be both. At the bottom end, the barrier to entry is very low. Yes, you need money. I think, what is it now? 250,000 rand to register on a national level, but if you win a seat, you get, I think, 1.2 million as an MP for working like 80 days a year, according to the Purple Cow Party. So, you know, the payoff is not bad. I guess you can.
And there are no interviews, no qualifications, nothing. Yes. You just have to be alive.
You have to be alive. You have to be alive. You have to pay the money. I guess you can't be convicted of like the most egregious crimes. I don't even know. It sounds really good.
Over 18.
So mainly, I'm torn. On the one hand, I think more democracy is better. More choice is better. Even if some of the choices are just, you know, bonkers, you know, even if it's like Claudie versus Mzwanele, and, you know. They're probably as good as each other, you know? I mean, put a positive spin on it. They might be as bad as each other, but they're probably as good as each other, which is a nicer way of looking at it. It makes things more messy. In theory, it should lead to more coalitions. And if the last 2-3 years has been anything to go by, it will be more instability. I don't know what the answer is. I believe in a strong a PR-heavy system like the one we have, maybe more constituency-based seats. I think there are other systematic and institutional reforms which are not about how we vote.
Yeah.
More important reforms that put more power back in the hands of people, like more open party lists. So instead of having this debate after the fact, maybe more input from the voters themselves or citizens on the ground saying, no, we don't want Mokonyane on the list. We don't want Batabile Dlamini on the list. You know, or we don't want Musi on the list or whoever it is.
Yeah.
And those reforms can be done. We don't have to change the voting system, but we do have to change our approach to how power is exercised and how it filters down or bubbles up from the people.
Okay, so but that leads now into the next question, which is this all a game about what happens on the other end? So
yeah,
after
like
the election,
yes. But the actors are a lot more ugly.
So, ouch. So, so, Sekunati, do you think this is about also the game of coalitions then and alliances post the election? So, you know, for example, Claudie couldn't get, remember he wanted to be on the NEC, ANC NEC. He wanted to be part of the ANC, couldn't get his way. So he goes in through another way, he gets a couple votes, gets into parliament, and then votes along with the ANC. On a bigger scale, the EFF seems to be playing quite a dance as well. I remember when I interviewed Julius Malema last year, before he decided I'm primeval or whatever, he said that the EFF had presented the ANC with a list of demands in 2016 in order to form a coalition then, post 2016 election. He said, as of last year, May, the ANC had met every single one of those conditions, except for the national anthem. Everything else, we talk about the removal of Jacob Zuma, the land question, everything that which in 2016 looked like a bridge too far, and the ANC had actually, you know, met the EFF. So there's this convergence of policies between the EFF and the ANC. Do you think that, you know, what Paul was showing us on the screen in terms of the coalition, that that's where we're heading?
I think coalitions will only matter in parliament once on the land question. There's no doubt the ANC will get a majority, a simple majority, but to change the constitution, then that's where the EFF will be needed to pass whatever amendment amendment they want. And the difference between the ANC and the EFF there is nationalization of all land for the EFF, expropriation of certain very strictly defined criteria or of certain pieces of land where it may be needed. Mm. So it's only one issue that they may need to be a discussion about how we vote. And then you come to a province like Gauteng, where the EFF might again be necessary for the ANC to get a simple majority to nominate the premier and form a government. Beyond that, there's really no need. We can then look at the next
So you're saying
election.
There will be cooperation, post-election cooperation pacts, but not necessary coalitions?
Not at all. The only parties that will need a coalition is the DA to govern Gauteng. Mm. And in which case the EFF will then say, okay, like they did the last time, and the EFF demand failed. Then they said, we don't want Mashaba for premier for the mayor. They have Mashaba and they are happiest with him now. So they will come and say, Soli, we actually tried to fire you in Pretoria, so we don't want you as premier of Gauteng. We might as well work with David Makura. Mm. I think that's where a coalition may come in, and that's the only province.
Okay, I'm going to open for questions just now, but there are two questions I want to ask. Jen, quickly on the issue of Gauteng. Mm. So the new dawn is at national level, but there's the old dawn in Gauteng because it's the same leadership. And you have things like Faith Mazibuko and her rant and Life Esidimeni. And then you have, on the other hand, what Sikonati is talking about, the DA, not really having a very strong candidate, so not presenting a strong alternative. And yet we have the situation where what we saw from Paul was a 50-50 probability. So why is this? Why do you think Gauteng is hanging in the balance like this?
Can I just add something to Sikonati's thing about the coalitions? I don't think coalition talks are going to be as easy. Not that they were easy in 2016, but the EFF is coming into this election with a very different thought. They want to go into government. Mm. They're not just going to say, okay, well, we don't like so-and-so, put so-and-so there and then we'll vote with you and stuff. They're actually going to want positions. They want MEC of finance, let's say. They would want to say Speaker of the Legislature. It's not going to be such an easy discussion this time. As much as they say, well, the ANC has fulfilled everything, they've made it quite clear, and it was an interview Floyd Shivambu did at the Business Day last year, they won positions. So it's not going to be so easy. Gauteng, the ANC of Gauteng were almost tried to come or came across a bit as the heroes during the last few years of the Zuma year. I think they were the first province to actually come out and say, I think their PEC took the decision that Zuma should resign or step down. But in between all of that, we've had the issues of Life Esedimeni, of Faith Mazibuko. And as Sikonathi said as well, things like load shedding that are affecting more your bigger provinces, your metros, and that is affecting Gauteng. So I think those small issues is actually what's pushing the balance between the two. It's a very different voter demographic to the rest of the country. Mm. I'm not quite sure how it's going to...
Don't you forget, though, that the largest number of people in Soweto don't pay for electricity. So yes. Load shedding does not exactly matter
to them.
Yeah. Okay, so just finally on the youth vote, Paul, you spoke about the largest proportion of voters are younger voters.
Young, we'll say under 40, broadly speaking.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's also been a statistic released that there's been a 47% drop in registration of 18 and 19 year olds, so first time voters, which means there's disengagement.
Right.
So I want to ask you and Kanita this question. Kanita, you, I think, out of all of us, you're the closest to that younger
cohort. She still qualifies for the youth league, yeah.
Yeah, for the youth league, yes.
For another 15 years still.
So why do you think there is this disengagement from politics as we know it and amongst younger people? Why are they opting not to vote?
I think it's simply because the average age of the list from all political parties to the national, you know, as candidates for the National Assembly, the average age is 60 and above. So it just doesn't make, you know, any logical sense. When we looked at the stage when the IEC signed the code of conduct for this elections, that, you know, it was old males. And so politics hasn't evolved at all. Mm. And I do think that there was this kind of panic when the EFF came into the play, because the EFF, you know, is young and vibrant, etc. And so what political parties, and the DA is also guilty of this, is, you know, you take young people with no constituency and you sprinkle them across into big roles in the National Assembly or in provincial legislatures, almost to fulfill, you know, that quota debate, and say, you know, we have young people. Our youngest person is 22. Our youngest person is 20. But really not going down to the heart of it. Number one, and number two is there's almost this misconception in politics that to attract the young voter, you have to dumb down politics, and you have to then make it about models and twerking and all of these ridiculous things, but really not engaging. For example, you know, having interesting discussions around, you know, free education, but how do you take it forward to say, oh, the ANC is giving free education, and then the DA is saying the ANC is going to, you know, mess up the education system. So the ability to take it beyond that and to appeal to young voters, and I think that the apathy among young people is as a result of that, and simply because there isn't some sort of definitive approach to how to deal with young people. And the second thing that interested me as well, if I just touch on the issue of the woman, again, 55% of the voters' roll is women, but it's a male-dominated election. And so it makes no sense that there's four political parties that are led by women, and most of the lists are male. If you take all, you know, 50 less parties that are contesting, so it seems as if you know, this election is the ultimate definition of madness, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Okay, let's take some questions now for the mic. Just hold on, wait for the mic, please.
Thank you. Two questions. The first is the EFF going to be at all vulnerable on the revelations from the PBS? And the second question, I don't know if, Paul, I'm sure you looked at the IRR cheat sheet. And if you take the feel favorable towards leader numbers at the national level, they add up to 124%. and at the Gauteng level, to 130%. In other words, just to give you an example, the ANC at the national level, 60.4% of the people interrogated were favorable towards Cyril Ramaphosa. In the DA's case, 31.5, and Julius Malema, 32.6. Does this indicate a massive level of indecision, or what?
Okay, Paul, I think you should take the question, the second question. Yeah.
Okay, so yes, second question. Short answer, yes, indecision. It is more than 100% because I think a lot of us are feeling like bigamists, or, you know, I feel okay towards more than one party. I'm not sure yet. I don't like any of them, but I'm sort of lukewarm when it comes to these. So yeah, I think your analysis is correct. People are undecided. People are caught a bit in the middle. In reply to your question, I think it could hurt the EFF, but not that much. Its supporters tend to be quite loyal. We'll be able to drill down quite a lot geographically to look at the area most affected. You know, the northern and the northern easternmost parts of Limpopo around Tohoyandou and in the Capricorn district, and be able to say these people are most likely to have been directly hurt by the fallout from VBS, and to see what happens with the EFF vote. But there are other explanations. It could be that there's a continued migration from Limpopo into Gauteng, and what the parties lost in Limpopo, it's made up more than in Gauteng.
Sikonathi, VBS?
If allegations of corruption did matter with the electorate, we wouldn't have had the ANC in charge after 25 years. So the EFF will be affected only in so much as somebody gets arrested and prosecuted. Right now, actually, it's a badge of honor to be accused of corruption. You go to parliament, that's it.
Okay, another question. Where's the mic, please? Here in front.
This
one here. One here, and then
there's a lady
here
behind as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so I noticed a correlation between some of the stats and what Sikonathi was saying. So you were talking about how the rural areas haven't felt the same kind of brunt from the lack of service delivery, which is interesting, and I'm curious if the pullout of votership in the different provinces and sects correlates to that. So are people coming through when they're not affected? Are we seeing that voter pullout come through in those areas? Or is it the areas that are being affected that are really pulling through for the elections themselves? Because that may correlate then to the ANC's power moving forward.
Sikonathi is correct in that traditionally, and increasingly over the Zuma years, the ANC's consolidated its rural support, and that it's got very few competitors in certain areas, except for itself. So most of the Eastern Cape, most of the Limpopo, definitely all of Mpumalanga, where the party is incredibly strong. There's no viable opposition except the party's mistakes itself, where people stay away. But unlike the US, because of the voting system that's different, I don't think this is a sustainable long-term strategy, because we are so proportional representation heavy. The long-term demographic trends are not just growth in the metros, but if you go one level down to what they call the secondary cities, Bombela, where there's Nelspruit, Solplaki, which is Kimberley, Rustenburg, Msunduzi, which is, help me out here, guys.
Pietermaritzburg.
Correct. If you look at all those areas, those 27 municipalities, which is about 10-15 of the total, is about to push over the 50% population mark. So we are continuing to urbanize. I'd rephrase it, the delay. There's going to be more of a direct effect of voters that live in that area when the lights go out, because you might not pay for electricity, but you might not go to work, and you stand the risk of losing your job if your employer can't keep the lights on. So those effects will become more direct. They'll become more immediate. People will have higher ambitions and expectations than just receiving a social grant. The need for employment or to grow employment will become stronger. So I think long term, the ANC has got its work cut out for it.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. My question is regarding the number of registered political parties that are appearing in this 2019 elections. We've seen that we've got like a 32% growth since the first elections, about 48 parties that are registered. So my concern is, should there be stricter rules of registering a political party? Because now we see that it's 200,000 to register, and then plus 45,000 to register for per province, and then with any other thing that is needed. And then at the end of the day, you get a job that pays about 86,000 or 100 and something thousand when you are a minority leader. So for me, it looks like people or those who are starting these parties now, they're just going to parliament just to get away from the crisis that the normal citizens are currently facing. I say this because currently in the National Assembly, there's 400 seats in the parliament, and then the minority parties have like one or two seats. And then, as you said before, that only 71% of the population is registered to vote. So I see no need for us to have 48 parties showing on the ballot paper, but we're seeing that growth of 32%. So going forward in the next elections, how many more parties are there going to be registered? So yes, that's my just question or my thought on Thank that.
I think what you seeing is it's due to fracturing, right? And where people, because of, I think, a lot of the developments in the ANC. So, you know, all the, so Hlaudi and, Zwanele's party. But there's also this phenomenon of this church, the ATM party. So people, so for example, religious organizations have large turnouts of people, large memberships, and they're trying to translate that politically, right? So there are different phenomena that lead to this proliferation of new parties. What do you think, Kanita?
Can I just jump in here? Because if you look at the ballot paper, you can almost cluster political parties, right? So you have a large chunk of it to be religion-driven. So your Christian parties, so a lot of that is sort of clustered together. Then land is a good feature. There's a lot of sort of land-based parties that have reared their heads now. Then there's like this ultra-liberal upsurge of just people thinking, and besides the purple cows, there's a whole political party that's dedicated to shutting down public hospitals and that the whole country must be on medical aid. You know, South Africa is alive with possibilities. So this kind of thematic, and then obviously the very Africanist orientated, and then the socialist slash worker situation with NUMSA now forming a political party. And so I found that quite fascinating, that it's more thematic and more, so you see land, sort of Christian, that kind of thing, and a little bit away from the minorities, the sort of the racial, based parties. I mean, they're still there, colored people, but it's still a little bit more, almost on the lines of the ANC and the ANC's failures, but to get to the point of whether there should be a benchmark. Continue. So in 2016, Gwede Mantashe was sulking, and he said,
Gwede Mantashe is always sulking.
he said it's easier for a smaller party to get a seat than the ANC to get a seat, and that's true, right?
Because of the maths and these very arcane rules, the fraction of the vote, it can be easy at the margin. For any one party to get an extra marginal seat based on their fraction, they can only win one more. But five small parties can each get one seat. And Gwede will feel, because he's the incredible sulk, that those five seats should have all come to the ANC.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left. Wow.
We'll sit here all day.
We'll have another event next week.
Okay, let's just take a cluster of questions, if you can just make
just
them brief.
Just to the panel, is there a possibility in this election for large-scale rigging to take place and cheating? And just if some of you could explain to the audience, how does the ISE actually prevent this taking place? And then the second question is, could the ANC ever work with a DA after this election in leading the country.
Thank you. Can we take another question there, please?
Thank you once again. Good morning, good afternoon to all. Just 2 points. I think Ms. Hunter made the interesting point about, I mean, picking up from where you're talking about, subtle, what I call subtle vote rigging. We don't get obvious vote rigging. It's very subtle, and it takes different forms. The one form for me is, for example, handing out food parcels. That I call subtle vote rigging. Now, that, it has decreased considerably in my mind. The only recent obvious one the other day was when the president was handing out tablets. You recall just the last
week? Yes, but that's government policy now.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that all these projects are held together for the month before the election. It's what you call subtle vote rigging.
Okay,
so but that's just the point I was making, an observation. And just the second thing is, I've been a party animal for all my life, and it's the first time, you know, we use this word once in a while, conundrum. It's the first time I personally have great difficulty in deciding. So I think most of us are feeling that way as well. Just an comment.
Okay, thank you. Can we have another? Okay, so you've asked already. Can we just have somebody new, please?
The hairy gentleman at the back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And here's the lady with the mic already.
Okay, yes. Okay, let's take you first.
Oh, I just wanted to ask if there's any sort of, if you guys on the campaign trail or in terms of sort of stats, see anything about older white people sort of considering the ANC. This might be as bad as your shopping mall example.
Older
white people.
Peter
so my
Bruce.
Mom is like 38 and her Dutch reform tannies, they're actually considering and actually having conversations, and they're solid DA voters about voting for Cyril. So I just want to see if there's anything that you guys have seen that point towards that.
All right, let's take one more question. Thank you.
I just wanted to shift the question away from who's going to be, how the parties are going to do to what's going to happen with the parties after the elections. And the three main ones. So what's the performance, who's likely to be, to come in, and what's their performance likely to be? It looks like the DA has sort of blooded people that have moved out of parliament fairly quickly. It seems like the ANC for the first time is having people move up from local to provincial and from provincial to national, and what that's going to do. And then also, like specifically with the super ministry, it doesn't look like Ibrahim Patel is going to be an MP directly. So if he would be appointed, it would be at Ramaphosa's discretion. And what does that also mean for what will happen with the DTI and with the Economic Development Department and those types of things? What's going to happen with governance and the performance of parties going forward and looking at the lists? I know it's quite a different question, but I also think it's interesting looking at the party lists and also how there's sort of circulation, let's say, with the DA, and it's now the second parliament that the EFF is going to be part of. How are our representatives likely to perform, and what are we likely to see?
Okay. Let's go for the vote rigging one first. Anybody want to, you want to
short answer, very hard to rig votes in South Africa. Very, very hard. It's not like America where, you know, the company that sells the vote counting machine is also owned by the guy who's the brother of the head state legislature controller. It's much better that we're not electronic, that we make marks on paper with pencil, that every single result down to the voting station level can be checked and double-checked by an opposition party before it's sent off. So every single result at the most disaggregated level can be checked. It would be almost impossible for a large-scale coordination of vote rigging.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The older white voters? What? Anyone have any...
I just have an anecdote. Can I just so 2 weeks ago, the Ramaphosa went to Germiston, where he addressed
the HIP,
so Hellenic Italian Portuguese communities, which have been sympathetic to the ANC in the past. It was not particularly new, but I was just quite flabbergasted with the turnout of middle aged white people coming out and queuing like a Home Affairs queue to get inside, you know. And there's almost and then another engagement last week in Cape Town where it's almost. But I don't know. I mean, this is quite controversial. I don't know if Ramaphosa is more palatable than Musi Maimane.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's the factor in that element.
I think that is a factor. That, you know, Musi Maimane was present almost packaged as a good black. You know, when he was presented as the candidate, and Cyril Ramaphosa is just so much better at
He's
that.
A better black.
And, you know, in some ways, it was funny. I was joking to one of my friends that he almost presents, he's got this almost in English gentleman air about him.
He's
very affable and, you know, he says the right things. Whether he can actually do it is something else. But what he says, I think, appeals to that constituency.
Small just thing to add along the lines of the Peter Bruce thing is I think we'll see more vote splitting. We've seen in the last two cycles more people will vote DA provincially in the Western Cape than nationally, and that's because the stakes are high, and in some places it was 5 percentage points or 6 percentage points, and the DA, because a vote for the DA provincially can actually count. I think we'll see similar things in Gauteng. There might be more provincial DA EFF votes.
Sikonas, can we make predictions on performance?
Yes, I can. The first prediction I'll make is Musa Maimane will lose his job after the election because he will be the first leader of the Democratic Alliance to actually lose its votes. So he will have to fall on his sword. You asked about how the government will be formed. So Cyril Ramaphosa has said and wants to have a cabinet of 20-25 members and as fewer deputies as possible. However, he's not in charge. The National Executive Committee of the ANC is in charge, and he's got a very thin majority there. So he will, as far as he can, for example, merge economic development with the Department of Trade and Industry and have one minister and a deputy. You'll definitely not have a ministry of women. It might be called something else, women, disabilities and everything. It might be called something else, but it will not have its own minister. You will lose. You've already lost one of the communications departments. There was post and communications and there was communications. It's now one department. It will formally be one department. So the cabinet will shrink massively, which again poses a threat to Ramaphosa. There's one thing that not many people realize about South Africa and the ANC in particular. We only 44 people away from a vote of no confidence. We just need, in the NEC, a simple majority of 44 people can pass a no confidence vote in their leader and get rid of him. Right now, we've got more crooks than statesmen in the NEC. Should Cyril Ramaphosa slash the cabinet aggressively, and in so doing, he'd have to get rid of the most powerful people, Bathabile Dlamini, with the Youth League, Nomvula Mokonyane, you by now know her power. And so those are the direct threat. He will have to threat very carefully, because any 44 of them at any given point can fire him, not only from the ANC, but from the Republic as president. You haven't thought about that, am I right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just 44 people. I repeat this, because the NEC is, what, 86 18. Members?
Although they don't vote.
Who doesn't
there hasn't
vote?
Been the tradition of the NEC voting. Votes. They make decision by consensus.
Well, when Derek Hanekom raised a motion of no confidence, what happened there?
But they didn't vote.
They didn't vote. Yeah. A large number, enough of them, those that made enough noise, dragging the rest. Mm. Now, if the whole thing about politicians, self-preservation, if Malusi Gigaba does not go into parliament, he goes to jail. If Ace Magashule does not keep that position, he goes to jail. And there's one person that that really would be responsible for that. It's the leader of the party. Mm. Go for the leader of the party, and then you can have a Jacob Zuma kind of person in there, or you can even have a David Mabuza as president. Then all the thieves are safe. That's the trade-off. They don't vote because the situation has not been as tense as it could be. Mm. When either of the parties feel we can win this, they will push for a vote. And you need just a simple majority of 44 people in the NEC, and you and I, we can register or not register to vote and send people to parliament. It don't matter in that scenario. 44 people meeting at Irene in a hotel there, and they send a letter to the Secretary General of the ANC, who sends a letter to the Speaker to recall the President and have a fresh vote. Thank you.
All right. On that terrifying note, and it's just get some closing remarks if any of you are dying to say anything in closing. Paul?
A little bit more positive. Yeah, okay, I'll go last.
Yes.
A bit more positive. Ramaphosa comes in before he's fired by his colleagues. The markets think, there we go, we've got a candidate for reform. He's won his outright majority. Let's start investing, Shamila. But when he starts arresting people, the economy starts pumping.
Kanita, is there a silver lining, you think?
I think there should be a silver. Well, I hope there's a silver lining. But there's two things that concern me about the elections that that people are not paying attention to. Is I don't know what the level of violence. I don't think there is that kind of tense situation as it were before in maybe 2016, 2014. But it's it's just the tension, political tension, and the fake news phenomenon, and that where that factors in this election. That's two important things the IEC has flagged as issues for this election. Yeah. And then the other issue is, the formation of governments, as you're talking about. There has been the sentiment that I think has led to more voter apathy, is that the elections is inconsequential. It's what happens in the ANC that matters. Yeah. I don't think that's true.
Okay. Jen?
I think just to add to what Sikonati was saying, I think it came down to the performance, and that I think what we need, what could maybe help Cyril in the removing of those people, is if that process of integrity commission asking people to step down works, then great, because you move those people out of parliament. Because you're reducing the cabinet, there are less jobs. And so if you leave those corrupt ones in parliament, they're sitting on the benches, and they will fight Cyril on the benches in parliament, as you said, and they can have a vote and they can vote him out. So I think we have to, as much as everyone's like, oh, the Integrity Commission, what's actually going to happen? We need to watch that, because that's the only way of actually rooting that out of parliament and actually helping him, because the real opposition to Cyril is going to be his own party in parliament.
Yeah. Paul.
Okay, so just a couple of quick closing points. Because of the system, and I think we probably answered the question of what's the magic number of parties. I don't know the answer, but our system does in theory lead to more instability, to a more fluid situation. That can be good and bad, but at the moment things are highly unstable, and probably likely to get more so, especially
positive.
neutral. It's unstable. We don't know. There's a lot of instability. It will probably lead to very different outcomes, so it's too soon to tell whether it's positive or negative. And as a bit of a self-own, the trends we've identified in the past that we're using as a sort of our bedrock for our model going forward, they might not hold. The big three, whoever they are, whether it's COPE or EFF or IFP, they might not control 90% of the vote between them. There may be more fracturing. The trends we've seen before might suddenly reverse, and we've only just got good at predicting the past, let alone the future. So the last point I want to make, which has only been tangentially touched on here, is that voters are generally intelligent. Voters are complex. I get really tired of reading, especially opposition supporters, saying, well, if only the populace was better educated, they'd all see the light and they'd vote for Musi. And, people, why do they vote against their own self-interest? People are complex. People have constructed identities. People can make many choices and sometimes seemingly act against their own self-interest. They can be swayed by hope, Stockholm syndrome, all sorts of things. But people aren't stupid. And I think we need to, going in these elections, just be more respectful and more lacquer towards each other.
People can't see the light in Lord Shadow.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming and thank you for supporting us. Please continue to follow our election coverage on our various platforms, Business Day, Financial Mail, Sunday Times, and websites, Times Live and BD Live. And please support us when we have our events again. Thanks very much. Thank you.